following interview with Douglas MacArthur II is a joint project of the Columbia Oral History Project and the Foundation for Iranian Studies. The interview took place on May 29th, 1985.
Where were you born and raised?
I'm what's called a Navy junior. My father was in the Navy, and both my grandparents, one was a general, the other was an admiral. So I was brought up in a military family, and in the Navy in those days, we traveled all over. So although Washington was our home, it was East Coast, West Coast, depending on where our father was stationed and where the ship was. He died when I was only 14 years old. And we had a home in Washington, and this became my home until I came into the Foreign Service.
Mm-hmm. What is your general educational background?
Well, I went to public schools until I was 14, and then I went to, I think, one of the great schools in the world, which did a great deal for me, Milton Academy, a school outside of Boston, a private school, and from there I went on to Yale, where I majored in history and economics, because my goal was to get into the Foreign Service, and I graduated with a Bachelor of Art degree.
So how did you come to join the Foreign Service?
Well, in 1921, the Japanese Minister of the Navy invited the American Secretary of the Navy to come to Japan as a guest of the Imperial Japanese Navy, and to bring with him, that is the Secretary, the U.S. Secretary of the Navy, to bring with him all surviving members of the Annapolis class of 1881 and their wives who wished to come to a modern American, having in somebody of the present generation, having in mind the bitter war we fought and the role the Japanese Navy played in Pearl Harbor. This seems rather strange, but the reason for this invitation was that old Admiral Baron Urio, the Japanese Minister of the Navy in 1921, had graduated from Annapolis in the Annapolis class of 1881, and he'd been one of Admiral Togo's ship commanders in the war against Russia. And on the 40th anniversary of his graduation, he thought it was fitting to invite the American Minister of the Navy, Secretary of the Navy, and his classmates to celebrate the occasion in Tokyo. On that visit, the Secretary of the Navy had a boy of about my age, and like all politicians, good politicians, he didn't want to be accused of taking his boy along when others were left out, so he said to my father, "Why don't you bring your two boys along, and I'll bring mine along, and then nobody can criticize anybody." And we were left when many of the ceremonial formalities took place in Japan. We also went to China and the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Like, but in Japan, we were left in the hands of American vice consuls, usually, in Yokohama, in Tokyo, and in Nagasaki, where we stopped. And I was, as a young, impressionable boy, about 13, I was much impressed by the way these young men handled themselves in a totally strange and foreign environment, speaking the language and everything, and so I decided then that this might be a very interesting career.
When did you join the Foreign Service itself?
After I graduated from Yale in 32, passed my examinations that autumn for the Foreign Service, but we were in the midst of a deep depression, economic depression at that time, and the Congress had served notice on the State Department that it wouldn't appropriate any money for any new members of the Foreign Service for at least 2 years, so we were told to train ourselves for at least 2 to 2.5 years, and then hopefully there would be money appropriated so that we could be taken aboard. I shipped first as an ordinary seaman on the old Isthmian line, $18 a month, 3 months around the world or out to the Indian Ocean and back, and then I had graduated from Yale with a commission in the reserve. I took an ROTC course. I was brought up in that tradition that the first duty of citizenship is that every American should be prepared to defend his country in the event of necessity. And I was called to active duty with the 6th Field Artillery in Fort Hoyle. And I served there for a few weeks, and then the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, came along, and I was assigned to that. Went as number two in a camp of bonus marching veterans to the wilderness of Virginia. They got them as far away as they could into the wilderness so that they wouldn't create any problems. Mm-hmm. And then I worked in a boys' camp later, and then after about 2.5 years, I got the word that the budget had the money to take the new people aboard, and I joined the Foreign Service as a probationary vice consul assigned to Vancouver, British Columbia.
So what were some of your assignments during the late 30s and 40s?
Well, I went from 35 when I came in. I went to Canada, came back to the school, and end of 36, beginning of 37, the Foreign Service School, which you had to pass to continue on in your career. Then I was assigned to Naples for until 1938, and then I was transferred to the embassy in Paris after two consular assignments, and I was there at an intensely interesting time when war was obviously coming. It was visible. And I served in Paris 38-39. War broke out. And then in 1940, when France was falling, the ambassador elected to remain in Paris when the Germans came, and I was one of three Foreign Service officers assigned to go with the French government, which was retreating before the Germans. It went to Tours and Bordeaux, and we expected to go on to North Africa, but in Bordeaux, the armistice was signed when the government was there, and I then went on to Vichy. I served in Vichy from that July 1940 till November 1942, and during that period carried out two secret missions for President Roosevelt and Mr. Churchill, one to General Dagon, whereby we had hoped if, as and when we landed in North Africa, we could persuade him to assume command of the French, to be the French authority there. He would not play. The other to former Prime Minister Edouard Herriot. And he also worked with the French resistance, and indeed, to my astonishment, at the time of the liberation of Paris, later five members of the CNR, the Conseil National de la Résistance, that was the supreme resistance organization with the leaders of the different people, where five of them were people with whom we had worked in that period. Mm-hmm. They kept us alerted to the movement of German troops and Air Force dispositions in France, the naval movements of submarines and surface raiders and ships from the French ports. They took first the RAF, and then the RAF, after we entered the war, our aviators that came down, they hid them and smuggled them across to Sofia in Spain. And I remained in France until November 32, the landings in North Africa, and then the Germans seized us as hostages, and I was locked up in Germany from 42 to March 44. When I came back to, I was exchanged in a diplomatic exchange where we had grabbed some Germans in North Africa, including Ribbentrop's nephew and niece and some other people. And our embassy people who had been seized as hostages were exchanged against them. And then I was assigned to, summer, to General Eisenhower's headquarters, and I served with him in London and Normandy, and went on to Paris for the liberation of Paris, and on the liberation of Brussels, and then I was reassigned from his headquarters to the embassy in Paris as head of the political section. From there I I was there from 44 to 48, and then I was assigned briefly to Brussels, Belgium, until 49. I was chargé d'affaires there part of that time, and I was returned to the United States in 49 to become chief of the Western European Division of the State Department. And then deputy director of the Office of European Regional Affairs, which was the backstopper for NATO and and European unification. And then General Eisenhower, when he was chosen, selected by NATO as Supreme Allied Commander in December 41, asked me to go and be his advisor on international affairs, POLAD, political advisor, they call it. So I went with him, helped in the setting up of the NATO headquarters at Rocancourt outside of Paris, and served there. And then when he left to run for the presidency, about that time, President Truman designated me to be ambassador to Vietnam. But General Eisenhower felt that General Ridgway, who was succeeding him, had little, virtually no experience in Europe, and that I should stay there for 3 months after he left to run for the presidency. I stayed there and then returned to the United States, and while I was on the high seas, the elections to go to Vietnam, the elections took place. President Eisenhower became president-elect. And when I got to New York, I got where he'd like to see me, and he asked me if I would remain on in Washington in the department, because he didn't know too many people intimately in the department itself, and I was like an old shoe. I'd briefed him for almost 2 years alone every morning on what was happening in the world from 8:15 to 9 o'clock every morning, 5 days a week. So I stayed on and was named counselor, and remained in that job from 53, his inauguration, until the end of 56, beginning of 57, when he appointed me ambassador to Japan.
I have some questions about that period.
Yeah.
Through late 40s through 56 or so.
Yeah.
During the early 50s, when Mossadegh nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company, was this a question you discussed with Eisenhower or other officials in the State Department?
Before
you were the counselor.
I was counselor of the department, and I was coordinator of plans and policies for all our negotiations virtually with the Russians in that period of time, our meetings with our NATO allies and others. I was obviously aware of the information that we had about Mr. Mossadegh and his Tudor party, and the influence, the direct and influence that Moscow exercised in controlling that party. It was an arm of the Soviet Union's foreign policy, as communist parties, conventional communist parties are in other parts of the world. But I was not deeply involved in Iran at that time, primarily because we had as Deputy Undersecretary Loy Henderson, who had been ambassador to Iran, was extremely knowledgeable about it, and I played no particular role with respect to Iran. I did go with Mr. Dulles on his trips to the Middle East and South Asia. First trip was in, I guess it was beginning of May 19, first trip to the Middle East was May 1981. It was the second trip that President Eisenhower instructed him to take after visiting the NATO countries. And after that, I went with him on all the trips to that part of the world, India, Pakistan, Burma, Southeast Asia, and the like. In the trip in 53, however, that was in the height of the Mossadegh business, and we gave Iran the skip. We did the Arab countries in Pakistan and India, but not Iran. It was too ticklish and too delicate a time to have the secretary visit there.
Mm-hmm. But you don't recall any specific discussions of, like, policy towards Mossadegh and Iran and the Shah?
Yeah, we knew that Mossadegh was being manipulated by the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was not exactly, that was in the height of the so-called Cold War in our interest. We knew that one of the principal points the Soviets had made in their negotiations with Hitler Germany, was that they tried to get the Germans to accept Hitler's government to accept a clause in an agreement which said that the two governments, that is Nazi Germany and Communist Soviet Union, were in agreement that, quote, the region to the south of the Soviet Union in the direction of the Persian Gulf is the center of the aspirations of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we were quite aware of what they were up to because in 1943, at the Tehran Conference where Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt met, the three countries agreed that at the conclusion of the war in Europe, the forces of the three powers, all three powers had occupying forces in Iran at that time, would be withdrawn, and Iran would be treated as not an enemy country, but as an occupied country. The war came to an end in May 1945. We and the British withdrew within 6 months, as that agreement required. The Soviet Union not only did not withdraw their forces, they set up a puppet people's government in Azerbaijan and tried to tear off the whole northwest corner of Iran, thus cutting through the principal barrier to the Persian Gulf, which was the Turkish-Iranian frontier, which ran across the southern part of the Soviet Union. So we had no illusions at that time, and in our discussions, President Eisenhower was fully aware of what had happened in 46 in Azerbaijan, and Mr. Dulles, of course, was also. So there was nothing mystifying about the fact the Soviet Union was trying to move in and tear off first a piece of Iran with the idea of eventually controlling it and then controlling the Persian Gulf and the resources that rather important region contained.
Mm-hmm. Well, how large a role, how large a role did the oil issue play in discussions of Mossadegh and Iran at this time, in the early 53 or so?
Well, oil was obviously a very, very important issue, particularly to our NATO allies in Europe, because it was a very, very important source of energy at that time. It was before really anything had been much developed in Libya and the like, and oil was obviously an objective the Soviet Union had very much in mind, and so it did play an important role in the need to prevent it from falling a victim to Soviet aggression, direct or indirect. But I just don't recall any specific meetings with any specific things that were said, although that was obviously part of the broad discussions that evolved around the whole problem of the future of Iran.
Mm-hmm. At that time, how much did you know about the CIA role in assisting General Zahedi's return to power and the Shah's return to power in August 53 and the downfall of Mossadegh? Did you know anything about that at the time? Or?
Well, I was familiar with the fact that the Shah's return had been assisted by the CIA, but I was not involved in the direct business with Kim Roosevelt or others.
Or discussions or whatever. Yeah. Okay. Did you agree with what you knew? Did you think it was a wise? Did you agree with the policy or the decision?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I think I don't think there was, I can recall nobody that disagreed with the decision at that time, because the alternative was to turn Iran over to Moscow.
Mm-hmm. So
Mossadegh was really an ambitious man in his own right, but he was, in a sense, a Soviet surrogate.
Did you take part in any discussions during 53 and 54 that led to the consortium, that led to the organization of the consortium? And
no, Herb Hoover handled most of those, and I was familiar with them, of course, as one of the secretaries, as counselor, and kept fully abreast of all the developments, but they were handled largely by Herbert Hoover Jr., who was the number two man in the department. He was undersecretary at that time.
How would you characterize Dulles's and Eisenhower's general approach to Iran and the Shah, say after 53, during the mid-50s, from what you might recall?
I don't recall any particular elements in the mid 50s. We were, the United States government, the secretary and the president, were pleased to have the Shah back in there, not Mossadegh. But it would be misleading if I tried to reconstruct things that I just don't remember the details of.
No problem. After you were consul, you went to Japan as ambassador.
Yeah.
And you were ambassador to other countries.
I went to Japan as ambassador. Yeah. I was designated in December 56 and went in early 57. And one of the principal things that I did was to negotiate the U.S.-Japan Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security, which joins our two countries together, which was signed in the White House in 1960. You must remember that when I went to Japan, Japan had just emerged from occupation 5 or 6 short years before, and during the occupation, Japan signed a treaty with the United States, which in effect was the condition upon which its sovereignty was restored. That treaty gave us extraordinary rights in Japan that we had nowhere in no other country, military rights, in effect we could put Japan into, commit Japan to war virtually without even consulting them. There was a very good reason for that. The Japanese asked us to undertake the very heavy burden of assuring Japan's security. There wasn't a single man, Japanese, under arms in the period that treaty was negotiated by Secretary Dulles under the Truman regime. And if we were going to undertake to defend Japan against any aggression, then we had obviously to have rights to be able to move our troops around and do things that were necessary to that defense. So the obligation was a heavy obligation in terms of a political commitment. But by 1957, when I got there, the situation had changed radically. Japan had self-defense forces at that time, some 180,000. They had Army, Navy, and Air Force, self-defense forces. And it had emerged from the destruction and devastation of defeat into a country which obviously was going to resume an important place in the world, particularly in the economic and industrial sphere, because its economic base had been reestablished. And I'd been there a rather short time, and I was approached by Prime Minister Kishi, the Prime Minister at that time, who felt that the continuation of the umbrella of American military and political power was essential to a re-emerging Japan, a democratic Japan, but felt that in the face of a treaty that was very, very much one-sided with Japan, whereas we have treaties based on equality with neighbors such as South Korea, Philippines, Southeast Asia, the CETO Treaty and the like, that it was just a question of time when people who wanted to see Japan neutral and subject to extreme pressures from its two great neighbors, Communist China and the Communist Soviet Union at that time, would take advantage of this one-sidedness and the fact that we treated Japan as an inferior where we treated others on the basis of equality. So he, in effect, requested that the treaty be renegotiated. There were quite a few misgivings on the part of our military, which are understandable. Military, when they have certain rights to be able to do this and that and the other thing, don't like to surrender those. But the president, who had led a great alliance in war and in peace, it's very important to remember that President Eisenhower not only knew a great deal about alliances in war and peace, in fact, in war, he served under perhaps the three most difficult taskmasters an individual could serve under. I refer to Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and Charles de Gaulle. I can't think of three more difficult people to serve under. And then later, when NATO was set up in the years he was Supreme Allied Commander, 51 and 52, he had handled that alliance and relationship with great skill. He understood, as he said to me once, he said, Doug, he said, I don't care how solemn the occasion of a treaty signing is or how important the people that sign a treaty are. He said, once a country feels that its national interest is being rendered a great disservice by that treaty, the treaty is no longer meaningful or enforceable unless you're willing to land the Marines to try to enforce it, which is impossible. So the president understood the need for a revision. At the same time, he also made quite clear that it had to be, while respecting Article 9, the no war article of Japan's constitution, while fully respecting that, it had to be fully consistent with our other treaty engagements in Asia, Southeast Asia, and other parts of the world, which indeed the treaty was, and that's probably the reason it's lasted from as long as it has.
Hmm. And from Japan, you went to?
From Japan, I went to Belgium. Mm-hmm. President Kennedy asked me to go there. There were problems in our relationships with Belgium, centering to a considerable degree on what was happening in the former Belgian Congo, where an insurrection was going on, where the United Nations troops had entered, where there was a great deal of misunderstanding in this country about the role of Belgium, and our relations were not in the best of shape. I was fortunate in my 4 years there. I worked with one of the great, great leaders, Western leaders of the whole post-war period, Paul-Henri Spaak, Belgium's great foreign minister, who was the father, really, of the Treaty of Rome that set up the EEC. And, in fact, finally, the time came when the rebels in the Congo had seized some 2,000 foreign hostages. About 1,700 of them were Belgians, and the rest were a mixed bag of Americans and others. We and the Belgians mounted a military operation called Dragon Rouge, Red Dragon, and American airplanes carried a battalion of Belgian paratroopers. They dropped at Stanleyville just as they were starting, getting ready to execute hostages. They saved 2,000 hostages and at the same time broke the back of that insurrectionary movement that was being supported at the time both by the Moscow and Beijing. I was the U.S. coordinator for the military operation at Dragon Rouge, and in fact in the upstairs of the war room in Belgium was the upstairs sitting room in the embassy residence, which was only a block from the defense minister's office, a block from the prime minister's residence, and Mr. Spock used to come down and park a block away, and we used to meet there because the operation was conducted in secrecy to gain the element of surprise, because we feared that if it were known, the 2,000 hostages would be executed before we could do anything. Then President Johnson, after I, in 65, in 64, asked me to come back and be Assistant Secretary of Congressional Relations and work with the White House and, of course, Secretary of State, State Department, and the relationships with the Congress on matters of international action and concern to the United States. I said to the President when he asked me to take that job that I really was not too enthusiastic about it, because my whole professional life had been in the formulation and conduct of foreign affairs, and in effect I was a professional, and that was my profession. He was asking me to do something the equivalent of perhaps asking one of our top or leading surgeons who practiced medicine to abandon the practice of medicine and become a lobbyist for the AMA.
How about the fair specialist?
I said that I really, I'd take it on, but only for a limited period. So we agreed on 2 years. Actually, it stretched to a little over three before I escaped. And from there, I went to Austria, which was, after dealing with the Congress, sort of like going on a vacation. And we had no major problems with the Austrians, but we did have one intensely, it was intensely interesting from quite a different point of view. Probably at that time, the best window into Eastern Europe, Soviet-controlled Europe, that existed, because there's scarcely an Austrian that doesn't have relatives in the neighboring communist-occupied countries, in Poland. As the center of the Holy Roman Empire, all the great families came to Vienna, and in Poland and Hungary, Romania, Yugoslavia, which is a different category, of course, Czechoslovakia and the like. I was there during the Dubček Spring and the Soviet occupation and termination of that effort on the part of Mr. Dubček of Czechoslovakia to try to give, to have what he called socialism with a human face. And then I was sitting in my office one day when the telephone rang, and I got word that the President wanted me to go to Iran as ambassador. That was in 69.
This is President Nixon.
President Nixon.
Yes.
Bill Rogers, Secretary Rogers called me. He was Secretary of State at that time. And so my romance, if you can call it that, my affair with Iran started in that very, very late, the late summer of 1969.
Excuse me. Now, the same month that you became ambassador, the Shah visited Washington. This is October 69?
Yeah. I went over first to present my letters, and I had a very interesting experience. I went in and presented my letters in September. Mm-hmm. Then I was to fly back and be here when he made his state visit. And I went in, and after presenting the letters, he drew me into a little study, which was the practice, and we started talking. And I had had a meeting with him in Japan when he was quite interested in my views about how Japan was making such tremendous progress. And we started talking, and I was supposed to have 20 minutes with him, and then he said, I want to talk to you about Japan, because just as Japan emerged from feudalism to modern statehood in a very short time of less than 40 years, from 1867 when the Emperor Meiji overthrew the shogunate and started modernizing Japan by 1905, when they had defeated a great power coming from a country that in 1867, whose armed forces were armed with bows and arrows and spears, to a modern navy that destroyed the Russian fleet and whose army, he said, I want Japan to become, I want Iran to modernize, and my whole effort is to modernize Japan as Iran, as Japan was modernized in a very brief period of time. He asked me to come back the next day to talk more about matters, and I went back the next day and spent 2 hours with him. So I started off with a relationship with him that was one of a degree of intimacy which surprised me, because I had heard that he was rather aloof and distant.
Did the visit in October 69 have any special political significance? The visit to Washington?
It was, from the Shah's viewpoint, and I think from the administration's viewpoint, considered to be a great success. The Shah got along well with the president, and with everybody, in fact. And I attended the talks where the foreign minister, Mr. Zahedi, who had been ambassador to the United States, I attended those talks with the Secretary of State, there were a couple of meetings where the Shah met alone with the president, with nobody present, 20 minutes, something like that. And in these meetings, the Shah told me that he had raised the problem of strengthening and equipping Iranians' armed forces. That had been one of his principal preoccupations. And he was under the impression that there were no problems of any kind, and that he could obtain virtually anything that he wanted in the way of military equipment. I did not have that impression from what I knew of the talks. So I said to him, if you have that, there's no point in going back and to Tehran and having any misunderstandings. I think you ought to clarify with the president, since you got that impression from your private talk with the president. So he saw the president again, and then he went on home after his final little visit to the president. When I got back to Tehran, I asked him if he had clarified it. He said, well, no, he hadn't wanted to bring up the atmosphere had all been so good and everything was going so well that he hadn't wanted to get back at his last little meeting alone with the president just before he was leaving to return to Tehran. He hadn't wanted to get down into details and so forth.
I had the impression that at those meetings, the Shah brought up the idea of bartering oil for weapons. Is that the case, or I'm not sure?
He certainly brought up that idea. If it was at those meetings, or he had served his notice before and so forth, I just don't remember the details of the discussion on that. But certainly there had been the business of barter had been brought up by the Iranians, and we were quite aware that this was one of the things that he had in mind.
What was the U.S. response, the initial response, as you recall?
Well, I think I don't remember what the response was about the barter business. I do remember that, and it's a long time ago, but I do remember that we were careful to point out that the question of barter is a difficult. It involved problems of disposal, and our government, if we tried to barter oil, getting involved in the private sector, and in the oil business and so forth and so on, and the risk-based complications, there probably were better ways to go after the weapons that he had and pay for them. Hmm.
When you went to Tehran as ambassador, did you receive any special instructions, or you get pretty much of a free hand in terms of what your objectives were?
Well, I was thoroughly briefed before I went there on our basic objectives and purposes, and our objective and purpose was really to see that an independent Iran continued to exist and that it did not fall a prey to Moscow's ambitions in that area. And I might add parenthetically that in speaking about the military, the Shah's military requirements, he told me on more than one occasion that the reason that he was trying to amass such a large quantity of weaponry and trained military forces was that he had to face the prospect of a war on two fronts. One, a war with Iraq, which at that time was very, very much a Soviet client state. There were Russian advisors there. The Russians were supplying the military equipment to there had been and was a sporadic border incidents between Iran and Iraq, and the Soviet Union was supporting Iraq in its propaganda broadcasts and so forth. But the Shah said the basic objective of the Soviet Union is the Persian Gulf. And he said there are two things that they are trying to do. One is to position themselves to move into Afghanistan. And while it's all sweetness and light now, and they dug the tunnel and everything, this is the first step in a phased movement to expand southward into Afghanistan, and then we will be directly threatened from that source. The second aspect of a second front, in addition to Iraq, is the fact that Soviet agents and people that are trained from the great tribal group that runs from Afghanistan down along in both in Pakistan and Iran to the Indian Ocean, that great tribal group is being penetrated, and they have always had been difficult, and they have resisted central authorities in Tehran. But they are being promised by Soviet agents and by young people that have been taken and trained and educated in Moscow, that there can be an independent state. And if this happens...
Baluchistan?
The Baluchis.
The Baluchis.
The Baluchis of Baluchistan.
Can you turn this over? Slower.